Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, January 29th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You might have heard we've been doing this series leading up to the semi-quincentennial this summer. We've been going to tap rooms and taverns all across the region that have roots back to the 1700s. And we've been having conversations at those taverns and tap rooms about events that happened during the American Revolution. I had the privilege of going to Princeton late last year to talk about that town's role in the Revolutionary War. And more generally, the evolution of Princeton started kind of as a town molded in the shape of the monarchy and became a place where lots of folks were clamoring for independence. You might not know about the Battle of Princeton. It wasn't a huge military victory, but it was a really important emotional, spiritual inflection point for the Continental Army. Talked to a couple great experts, and we're going to bring you that conversation later in the hour, all about Princeton and the American Revolution.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing that conversation. By the way, can we take a moment and just say thank you to everybody who came out to Brittenham's pub last night? It was part of our Tavern 250 tour. We talked about the French influence on America's founding. So thank you to everybody who came out. And we had two great experts, and so hopefully they'll hear that. But today we're going to hear all about the Battle of Princeton.
It's also Thursday, which means we are looking for a DJ of the day. You might know that we end Thursday with a song picked by one of you on the theme of that day's show. So today is about
battles, history, George Washington,
New Jersey.
Yeah, all those things.
All right.
Winning.
So, yeah, winning. Okay, that's good. Winning.
Yeah.
All I do is win, win, win. So if you have a suggestion for a DJ of the day song, send it into studio2@whyy.org. EP Kevin will pick a DJ of the day, and we will shout out that DJ at the end of the hour.
Yes, I look forward to hearing your song selection. So
speaking
now,
of New Jersey, let's do a little local roundup here.
Trio of news stories. New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill made some headlines this week after saying her administration will take a stand against federal immigration authorities. Sherrill says New Jersey will create an online database portal where citizens can upload videos of immigration authorities in the state and warn people. Here's Mikey Sherrill on The Daily Show just 8 days after being sworn in as governor of the Garden State. She told New Jerseyans, if you see ICE at work in the state, get your phones out. Take a listen.
They have not been forthcoming. They will pick people up. They will not tell us who they are.
Right.
They will not tell us if they're here legally. They won't check. They'll pick up American citizens. They picked up a five-year-old child. We want documentation, and we are going to make sure we get it.
It was a 15-minute interview, Avi. Sherrill spoke out against the killing of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, and she talked about the significance of cell phone video in that case. Without that video, it would have been so much harder to counter the narrative put forth by the Trump administration. The governor said her administration is working to ensure that New Jerseyans know their rights, and her administration will also make sure immigration authorities cannot stage its operations on state property. She says she's already spoken to the state attorney general about these issues.
She also mentioned that states need to step up and push for more state power, saying that they're the rational actors in this situation. I'm very curious what that would look like in action, how you would codify that, how you would do it vis-a-vis the U.S. Constitution, which hasn't changed. So that was another comment that stood out to me in her interview and her remarks.
Yeah. So we'll be watching that. I mean, already taking stands just a few days in.
Story number two, Cherry, go ahead.
Yes, Simpsons, their 800th episode is coming up. Can't believe that. That's how long they've been around. And to celebrate, the show will feature a trip to Philadelphia and some of the city's biggest stars and iconic places. Cool write-up in Philly Voice about this. The episode is titled Irrational Treasure, in which Homer and Marge sort of stumble into a historical conspiracy adventure. The whole episode pays homage to the 2000s film National Treasure, if you remember that. I love that film.
Nicolas Cage,
Nick Cage in it. And the show will feature a bunch of Philly guest stars like Quinta Brunson of Abbott Elementary. She'll voice one of the characters. We'll also hear the voice of actor Kevin Bacon and Questlove of the Roots. The Boys to Men will sing versions of the shows open and closed.
Man, if you're a Philly celebrity and you weren't asked to be in this,
you might feel some kind of way.
I mean, they got everybody in there. Jeez.
I know. And we haven't seen a video preview, but they had some still pics. And they show Homer eating a cheesesteak between Pat's and Gino's, yep. You know, them at a Roots concert and some characters on a Segway tour in the old city. So there you go.
I love The Simpsons. I will confess I haven't watched in many, many years. It used to be my every Sunday show, but it's cool. I don't know why they would have picked Philadelphia for this landmark episode. It's not like...
What, the 250th, maybe?
Maybe, yeah, maybe that's it.
Maybe, you know, everybody's talking about the 250th. You want to ride the wave. And so they might have said, hey.
Yeah, they're riding the wave.
They're riding the wave.
Just like we are with this tavern tour. Us and The Simpsons. So simpatico.
No, that's right.
Anyway, so I'll look forward to that episode. This will get me to watch The Simpsons again, which, again, I love dearly. I just, you know, have lost touch with it. Maybe there will be a local athlete will make a cameo, perhaps.
Oh, you never know.
And on that note, Sixers fans are flooding the Google review page of Joel Embiid's knee surgeon leaving 5-star reviews. Okay, here's the backstory. Joel Embiid is the longtime star of the Sixers, phenomenal player. But over the last 2 years or so, he's really struggled with injuries that turned him into a shell of himself. Last year, he had knee surgery performed by a guy named Dr. Jonathan Glashow. And more recently, Embiid has really started to play well again, punctuated by a huge alley-oop slam dunk in the Sixers' most recent victory, which was stunning to see. So Sixers fans, of course, are elated by this turnaround, and they're leaving dozens of 5-star reviews on Dr. Glashow's page, saying things like, "You saved the city of Philadelphia. You deserve a statue. I hope I break my knees so you can fix them."
I love it.
And Dr. Glashow deserves a Nobel Prize for what he's done to Joel Embiid's knees. One happy fan even dubbed this man the LeBron James of surgeons. It's very entertaining to read the reviews. You should go check them out.
Yeah, and they said, "Thank you so much for saving Joel Embiid and the city of Philadelphia. You the real MVP." And by the way,
just some doctor in New York.
I love it. And by the way, fans just want to win again. I mean, it's been just such a struggle. Remember when tickets to see the Sixers were like $1?
Yeah, it was rough last year.
It was so rough. And so this man, Dr. Glashow, Jonathan L. Glashow, his name, I mean, somebody might get him a billboard because they're so happy. And if he, you know, if the Sixers actually win this season and get some big, you know, win some tournaments, I don't know what they do in basketball, but
sure, yeah.
But he's going to get an invite to the party.
I could tell how invested you are. I don't know, win some tournaments maybe. If they go far in the playoffs, if they win the NBA title, absolutely. We will be singing the praises of Dr. Jonathan Glashow. It's a very weird quirk of NBA sports media that often when a major player gets a procedure, like in the official press release, they'll shout out the doctor.
That's
which I assume is sort of like a little, you know, quid pro quo. That's in part why the doctor's doing this, because they want to get a little publicity. But it's great when it's positive publicity, and we love you, Dr. Glashow. And we would love to hear if you have miracle cures for what ails us.
Yeah, I kind of like it. And if you got to get your knee done, and this, I mean, if he's available, like, why wouldn't, I mean, he has a track record.
Go on Google reviews. People love him.
There it is.
And by the way, shout out to Sixers reporter Austin Krell. He was the one, I think, that identified this funny little trend on Google reviews.
All right. And
I know one person who would have loved this story, who loved quirky local sports stories, was writer and Philadelphian Dan McQuaid. Dan was part of our Studio 2 family. He lent his quick wit and pop culture mastery to our holiday movie special about a year ago. In this clip, you hear one of the things that made Dan so special, his intense love of all things Philadelphia.
I am a sucker for any movie set in a mall or a department store. When I was 6, Franklin Mills opened, and that was like the biggest event of my childhood. Maybe still of my life, like spent most of my life there. I've never been able to fully explain how big of that an event was to the people of far northeast Philadelphia, but it was.
Dan most recently wrote for Defector, Philadelphia Magazine, among many others. We learned the devastating news yesterday that Dan died from cancer. He was 43 years old.
Yeah, so many tributes coming in to Dan McQuaid. I didn't know Dan super well, but I will say he was unforgettable. His love of Philadelphia, the way he saw the world was remarkable. And you almost wanted to put on some Dan McQuaid sunglasses to just briefly see the world the way he saw it. And you heard me laughing because he just knew how to get a giggle. So
absolutely. People absolutely love Dan as a human being. I think we'll leave the more personal tributes for folks that knew him better than us. But before I ever met Dan as a person, I knew him as a writer, and he was absolutely one of a kind as a writer. And I wanted to mention quickly a story that I think really captures his specific genius. So a few years ago, Dan was at the John Bon Jovi service area on the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey, and noticed it was covered in quotes from famous New Jerseyans, including one from actor Ed Harris, which read, quote, "Acting is like scoring a touchdown." Strange quote. And Dan's journalist BS detector kind of went off, and he actually reached out to Ed Harris's people. And it turns out Ed Harris never said that. And it also turned out that at this John Bon Jovi service area of the Garden State Parkway, there were several misattributed quotes, including a fake Walt Whitman quote that was actually from a random advice column and a very bizarre quotation attributed to several Greek philosophers. And Dan wrote about all this for Defector. And I think some journalists, after finding these fake quotes, would have, you know, sharpened their swords, so to speak, but not Dan. His story is hilarious and endearing. And I think what he saw in these fake rest stop quotes was another example of the specific flavor of absurdity that you find in this particular corner of the world, New Jersey, Philadelphia. Dan was better at finding and writing about those absurdities than anyone I've ever read. You know, bootleg sports paraphernalia, Wildwood boardwalk t-shirts, TV news interviews with eccentric people. He would apply journalistic chops and curiosity to these subjects that people always overlook, and he always found gold. Thank you for that, Dan, and rest easy. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It's been almost 250 years since the Declaration of Independence was signed here in Philadelphia. To mark this anniversary, Studio 2 has been doing a series of conversations in local taverns that have roots back to the 1700s. And the bulk of today's program is from an event Avi hosted at the Yankee Doodle Tap Room in Princeton.
I was joined by Mimi Omasinski, founder of the Princeton Tour Company, and Will Krakauer, a historic educator and park manager at the Princeton Battlefield State Park. They told me about the grueling early days of the Revolutionary War, how George Washington almost faced a coup, and how the Battle of Princeton helped the Continental Army get its mojo back. But before all that, we talked about the founding of Princeton University and how it came to be a hotbed of a revolutionary fervor. We start the conversation here talking about Aaron Burr Sr., the founder of the university and father of that famous slash infamous revolutionary figure.
So Aaron Burr Sr. is kind of a fascinating guy. He's the son of a minister. He's going to marry a girl named Esther, and her daddy was Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was probably the coolest minister at the time. Everybody knew him. If you're from the South, we had to memorize something called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He was kind of a tough guy, pious, very severe, right? So Aaron Burr Sr. is going to marry his daughter. Instantly gives him credibility. Now he's trying to create a college. Why do we want colleges? Because the king loved colonial colleges. Why? Because they're not like schools that we know today. They were schools for ministers. Why does the king care so much about ministers, young boys becoming ministers? He's in competition with the Pope. So the more likely you have successful ministers coming out of your little sweet town, the more likely the king is going to get a crush on you. Back then, we tried to start the College of New Jersey in Elizabethtown, New Jersey. And we got the money, but we couldn't get the land and the timber, which was a big deal. The timber's just to keep the boys warm during the winter months. Then they're going to move it to Newark, New Jersey. And this is Aaron Burr Sr. He enters, takes it to Newark, New Jersey. Can't get all the elements, the three elements, really. Also, it's too close to sinful New York City. So he's going to say, am I wrong on that?
No, no, mustn't go to New York
City. Oh, good, 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 good. I was ready to get corrected.
We agree. We all hate New York.
Okay, okay, shoot. So I got that part right. Okay, so Aaron Burr Sr. then is going to say, let's move this thing to the middle of nowhere, New Jersey. And that's going to be Princetown, right? Named after the king's son, Prince William III. So when he moves the college here in 1756, he's in it to win it to impress the king. He gets the number one theologians from all over the place. Number one faculty.
So one of our audience members wanted to know about Nassau Hall, which is, well, let me make sure we get this right. That's like the OG hall of Princeton, what becomes Princeton University, the original. The whole thing was in there.
Original academic building.
The original academic building was Nassau Hall.
It should be noted that most of those early classes were being done in private homes and taverns.
Yeah. Yeah, like this tavern tour. Yeah,
right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So you have the college. Nassau Hall, which is still here today, was at the time the largest.
The tallest
building in colonial North America.
Having the largest building in the colony at the time was a really big deal to stand out. Yeah. Because Princeton's equal distance from Philadelphia and New York City, right. This was the popular stagecoach layover town. The horses just had to finally sleep, and the drivers had to rest. And so Aaron Burr Sr. thoughtfully thought, okay, if I have the biggest building in the colony, I'm going to get noticed. More likely, young boys will want to come to this new college.
Yeah. It's like an advertising tactic almost.
He was brilliant.
So we've got a little bit of a baseline here. Let's speed it up to like the eve of revolution. Let me get a sense from you, Mimi, of what's happening in Princeton. Do we know if this is a hotbed for revolutionaries or loyalists or just kind of a healthy mix in between? What's going on in Princeton, let's say early 1770s?
So I think the big deal is the arrival of John Witherspoon. So John Witherspoon, he's in Scotland. Everybody knows him. He's this great minister. Everybody loves him. There's two guys here in Princeton, and they really want this guy to become president of the College of New Jersey. And the college is having a tough time. So we start with Aaron Burr Sr., right? Aaron Burr Sr., believe it or not, he's gonna get here. A couple years later, maybe a year later, he dies, his wife dies, and then his father-in-law, John Edwards, is going to take over the college. And the first five college presidents, frankly, are going to die quickly. John Witherspoon gets here. The mood in Princeton is there's a new cool cat in town.
Yeah.
And the college was suffering, and he's going to figure out how to make it not suffer. He'll get a new group of students to come here. They're mostly going to be Southern plantation boys. The boys are going to bring their money. They're also going to bring their African-American slaves. This is going to create a Southern sensibility here in Princeton, frankly, that'll last for a very long time. So he gets here in 1770. Mm. 6 years later.
Yeah, what a time to arrive.
Yeah.
He signs the Declaration of Independence. So you've got John Witherspoon. He's the clergyman. He's the one that gets everybody fired up in the church to want to fight the Revolutionary War.
So Princeton is just kind of trying to anchor itself at this moment in time. The school's trying to survive, and it's attracted this new clientele from the South.
Yes.
And that's just what? Because it's the closest of the prestige schools or potentially prestige schools? Like, why would that be the case?
So the real reason, in my opinion, is that it was the curriculum. This group of ministers were really unique, avant-garde, if you will. They're going to teach your young son, average age would have been 13 years old, young son, all about God the Father. Let's get him into heaven. And God the Creator. So they're teaching hard sciences alongside a charismatic Christianity. Harvard, Yale, William & Mary, not so much into those hard sciences. Moms were really afraid of the hard sciences. Two reasons. One, my kid is a boy and 13 years old, might give up on God with all that dualistic thinking, right? And the point is to make them a minister. The other is God may not like it. Why are we delving into the mysteries of Christ? John Witherspoon, all the Presbyterian guys here, they're like, what are you talking about? This is God's creation. Part of the responsibility of being a human is to know about creation. Mm. And that was the big deal. So he couldn't get Northern moms to send their boo-boo to a private education
here. To enlightenment
They were just
it was cutting edge, right? We're on the back end now of the Great Awakening, the sort of religious revival movement, and this is the product, right? These were the men, they were growing up, learning to be ministers during the Great Awakening, and then they come, and they're brilliant, and men like Witherspoon are riding this line of, we want to teach a more complete vision of what their religious worldview was. It's worth mentioning, in December of 1773, a major event occurs, the Boston Tea Party. In January of 1774, about a month afterward, the students of the College of New Jersey break into the commissary, steal about 20 pounds of tea, and it's in crates, and then they go door to door in town. There's about 60 buildings here in Princeton, door to door, banging on the door, forcing people to give them their tea, and then they light it on fire in front of Nassau Hall.
Yeah.
Huge bonfire.
Yeah.
Call this the Princeton Tea Party, right? It gets a little bit of press, right? Which is why we know so little about it, is because it appears maybe only two or three times, and there were only a few accounts writing about it. But I think it's an important, right? This is 74. No shots have been fired yet.
Yeah.
Right? And at least.
So there's some revolutionary fervor here.
But it's, where is it?
It's the
school,
kids.
Right?
Yeah, it's
right? It's these young men and their professors, mm-hmm. you know, the minister teachers, who are getting them fired up. Nobody blames the king in 73. Nobody blames the king in 74. Even in 75, nobody blames the king. It is the corrupt ministers of parliament who are doing these things. His Majesty has been chosen by God. Surely, this man who is endowed by God to lead the people, the British people, and they did consider themselves British, could never break the covenant, right? Listed in the Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. We put you in power because God put you in power. Mm-hmm. Keep us happy, you be happy. So we're not blaming the king. We're blaming the parliament and its ministers. Ooh, that veneer is starting to crack. In 74, right? And the first time anybody's going to put down on paper that this is the king's fault is going to come July of 1776.
That was Will Krakauer, historic educator at Princeton Battlefield State Park, and Mimi Omasinski, founder of the Princeton Tour Company.
We just heard how Princeton University went from a college named after the monarchy to one where the students were taught to question everything, even the king. In just a moment, we'll hear about what life might have looked like for students if they joined the Continental Army. Stay with Studio 2 to get that insight, and spoiler alert, it wasn't great.
Oh. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The bulk of today's show is based on a conversation I hosted in Princeton at the Yankee Doodle Tap Room as part of our series tied to the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Our guests were Will Krakauer, historic educator at Princeton Battlefield State Park, and Mimi Omasinski, founder of the Princeton Tour Company.
We pick up Avi's conversation here about what revolution actually looked like on the front lines in late 1776 as General George Washington and the Continental Army were desperate for a turnaround.
The war has been going on for about a year and a half. Right? Couldn't be going any worse. That's not true, because they're about to go even worse.
All right, nice.
The British have absolute coastal dominance. You know, they can shell any one of our forts and do shell every American fort in the South. In the North, we have, by the fall of 76, are licking our wounds from a failed invasion of Canada. Raise your hand if you knew we invaded Canada during the American Revolution.
Did not go well.
A couple of folks out there. Everybody's eyes are on New York and Philadelphia. And in the fall of 1776, we're about 3 months into what we call the New York campaign, which began in the summer of 76. Lord William Howe, the overall commander of British forces in North America, has launched a devastating invasion of Long Island, swept across the East River, and defeated Washington, who is in command of the Continental Army, in every battle he's fought. Up the island of Manhattan, and then out and around, we'll lose the Battle of White Plains, We lose Fort Washington. 3,000 American soldiers are captured, many of them drunk because they've just given up. And then we will lose Fort Lee on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River. When we lose Fort Lee and the Continental Army enters New Jersey and then flees across New Jersey, the British follow. And they follow at a clip, but not doggedly. Right? They're not hunting down the army. They want Washington to escape. The reason for this is, how do you win an unwinnable war? Right? How do you, as a commander of an army, which you view as an army of liberation, but also are very aware that there's a substantial portion of the population that will view your army as an army of occupation, how do you win that war? And the answer is hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to convince the people of Princeton and of New Jersey that seeing a red coat is a safer bet than seeing a blue coat. Mm. Right? And one of the things that has occurred is the king has issued a proclamation. Right? Sign this proclamation, declare your loyalty right. to His Majesty and to the Parliament, disavow this illegal Congress, and you will be safe, right? We're not going to collect your land. We're not going to take all of your stuff. You're not going to be thrown in jail. You're not going to be executed, right? Worth mentioning that we think we're a country. Great Britain does not, mm-hmm. which means that they don't have to follow any of the rules of war. So any American captured in arms against Great Britain means they can simply be executed for treason. Right. No court-martial, no legal jurisdiction. They can just kill them for being a traitor. It's now December of 1776. Washington's army reduced to a fraction of its original strength. Washington is being picked at from all sides, right? Mm. He had lost New York. He had lost an army of 25,000 men. He has officers under his command petitioning the Congress to remove him from command of the army.
Now, I'm thinking at this point, if I'm a colonist who joined the revolution, get me out of here.
It's over.
Yeah, let's go back with the king. That wasn't that bad.
They're done.
I mean, so what's Mimi, you're thinking like morale's pretty low, I would imagine, among the folks who signed up for this. Things are teetering. Is that your sense of it?
Well, like Will's saying, I mean, you know, we had won so much before we signed the Declaration of Independence. That's the only reason we were brave enough to even declare independence. And then the minute we declared independence, the king was like, really? Y'all want to play? I'm going to bring the largest navy in existence, and I'm just going to attack New York. Well, we never thought of that. And so we kept losing. We start with 20,000 troops, I guess.
25,000.
Even more in July. And then by Christmas Day, we're down to 5,000. It's not because they all were killed. It's because a lot of them were like, you know, I got a farm to take care of.
I got a thing to do.
You know, yeah. I got to be at that place at that time with those people kind of thing. And it just, nobody would have blamed them because we were losing so much.
Yeah.
There's a sense that maybe the colonists overstepped, got a little ambitious, and now here comes the reckoning.
Don't forget, the British were professionally trained. In Britain, you would become a soldier, and that was your job for the rest of your life. You did not question the command. George had been trained as a British soldier. So when he gets in charge, he's thinking everybody's going to do what I say. Just do what I say. Well, we had all these different volunteers coming in to fight. So if I'm from Virginia, I'm like, George, we're going to win with a rifle. If I'm from the Northeast, George, we're going to win by boat. So we are independent thinkers. Everybody showed up and they're like, well, no, I'm having a magical thought. I think we're going to do it this way. Right. And George is like, can I ask everybody to calm down? Just do what I'm saying. So in defense of George, right, he gets everybody who won't just do what he says. So now leading back up to Will, what Will's saying, which is that's why they're so mad at George Washington. And in my opinion, that's why we weren't winning. Okay, go ahead.
So there's a lot to be said for the structure of the Continental Army. This is the first army of its kind. It is a volunteer army. So, right, we can't keep the men in the ranks. And on the 31st of December of 1776, General Washington is going to lose his army.
They've done what they signed up
for. Right, they've done what they signed up for, and they are not coming back.
Got it.
Right?
So that inspires, on some level, the escapade.
Yeah. This is
of crossing the Delaware. He doesn't just need a win tactically. He needs a win, like, in the hearts and minds of the men who are fighting.
Yeah. This is the back against the wall. You've been losing all night at the poker table. You've got two chips left, and you just have to go all in. Because if you don't, you know, you're cleaned out.
All right. So now, a lot of people know this part, right? Christmas 1776. This is the moment that's, we've seen the pictures. We surely read about it in grade school. Washington crosses the Delaware. So remind us of that, Will, and the significance of it leading up to the battle.
In the scale of the wars, it's a small battle, but it's a miraculous battle for Washington and the Continental Army. It's almost perfectly executed. The people, not just the British and Hessian soldiers and their officers, but the people in New Jersey could not fathom that we had pulled this off, right? And so rumor spreads. What's the rumor about the Battle of Trenton? You probably remember it from grade school. How did we win?
Well, they were all drunk because it was Christmas.
They were all drunk because it was Christmas. That is a myth that was started almost immediately from the day of the battle because we couldn't comprehend that we had done this thing.
To explain the inexplicable.
Right. And the reality is, no, the Hessians were exhausted. They were worn out because not only were they facing off against the Continental Army, the New Jersey militia finally wakes up and begins harassing the Hessian outposts and the British outposts to a point where they were so strung out that they were literally going to sleep, what they call under arms, which is fully dressed with cartridge boxes ready and weapons loaded. They were ready for a fight. What they weren't ready for was for Madman Washington to cross the river in the middle of the night, in the middle of a nor'easter.
So Washington crosses the Delaware. It is a military win.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But how important is the military win compared to, I guess, the win in terms of mojo and momentum?
The impact of it is substantial. We'd never won with Washington in command yet, right? We haven't experienced, we haven't tasted victory before. And so this army that has spent the last year and a half starving, bleeding, losing, and dying finally gets its taste at Trenton, and morale's high again, right? We get the spike.
Yeah. And obviously that's big for keeping the guys in the proverbial boat because their enlistments are about to be over at the end of the year, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's really early 1777.
Yeah.
It's getting cold.
It's already cold. It's only getting colder.
It's only getting colder. So one of my initial thoughts when I thought about this was, at this point, why aren't we sort of like resting for the winter, hunkering down? Why is there even another battle of Princeton in the early days of 1777? Why do these sides even meet again?
Good question. And the answer is, where are you going to go, George? Right? Washington crosses the Delaware on December the 25th. Successfully makes it over to the Jersey side on the morning of the 26th, raids Trenton that morning, and then crosses back into Pennsylvania, right? Good plan. To his north is Maidenhead, today that's Lawrenceville, and then Princeton, occupied by British troops. To his south is Bordentown, Burlington, and Mount Holly, occupied by Hessian troops and British troops. So he's stuck if he stays in Trenton, so he crosses back. What he doesn't realize is the impact that the First Battle of Trenton ends up having, and that is that the rumor begins to spread. 30,000 bloodthirsty rebels descended upon the Hessian garrison at Trenton and killed them all. It's not true. But in this case, misinformation helps out.
Yeah.
And so all of those forces south of Trenton end up moving north. Where do they move? Princeton, crossroads town. All roads.
Wait, so these troops came to Princeton because they were under the impression that the Americans were far more formidable than they really were.
Right. As we move forward into the final days of December, word begins to spread. He's stuck in Trenton. He can go south, but South Jersey is occupied by Quakers.
Right.
Quakers who are pacifists and have no interest in helping the Continental Army. So you can't go south. You want to go north. To go north, you have to go through the British Army, right? There were only about 1,400 Hessians in Trenton. Washington had an army of about 2,500 men when he crossed the Delaware River. Now his army has grown thanks to the local militia coming in, Philadelphia Soldiers. He's got about 5,000 or 6,000 men. But the British Army is now coalesced in Princeton, a force of 8,000 to 10,000 men. And so Washington is basically staring down the barrel of the gun. But he knows that the 31st is coming. The enlistments of the men who had signed up were going to expire. And so he's desperate for another battle. He's building up defenses in Trenton. He's begging the British to come get him, and they don't. That's because British spies are just as good as American spies. And they know that those enlistments are going to expire at the end of the year. And Lord Cornwallis, who is now in command of this particular body of British troops, is no fool. Why waste a good British life when the army is simply going to disappear come the 1st of January? Washington sits and waits and waits and waits, and the attack never comes. So on the 31st, he makes an impassioned plea to his men. Your country is at stake, he says. You'll render a service to your country, which you will never again have the opportunity to do. Think of your wives, your homes, your children. Never forget the American Revolution is a war about property. Think of your homes, for your property. And he promises them, in exchange for an additional 6 weeks of service, a $10 bounty. So think about next time you have to spend $10 on something. Now, it's about the equivalent of 2 or 3 months' wages. So that's not a bad deal for laborers in the 18th century. And most of them will take it. So the army is saved. Check that one off the list. George can wipe a little bit of sweat away. January 1st, 1777, we've entered the new year. We call it the Year of the Hangman, which I love because it looks like a gallows, three sevens next to each other. It rains. It pours on January 1st. So both armies are stuck. January 2nd, the game is on. It's the only battle in the entire history of the American Revolution where everything went according to plan for General Washington. Nothing went wrong. Everything went exactly the way it was supposed to. And the result is the British are lured down into Trenton, and Washington gets that second battle he was hoping for, but the sun goes down, and the result is largely inconclusive, although the British have taken a substantial amount of casualties. And so the final council of war on the evening of January 2nd, midnight is approaching, and Washington has his officers gather for the final decision. Do we stay and let Cornwallis attack us again in Trenton? We have a well-fortified position. It's worth it. Do we retreat into South Jersey? Can't go to South Jersey. It's Quaker territory. We can get closer to Philadelphia, but all of the steam we've built up may go out. The opportunity presents itself in the form of the spy map. A young man of good character, allegedly a student of the College of New Jersey, who is not in arms with the soldiers, but he's still putzing around the area here, as college students are wont to do, draws them a map of a back road leading off of what was known at the time as the Quaker Road. Today it's Quaker Bridge Road, for those of you who are local, leading into Princeton through this Quaker settlement. So this map ends up in Washington's table during this decision, and they say, oh, well, here's a back way to get to Princeton. It's called the Sawmill Road. It led to, well done, a sawmill, and it was built by the Quakers. So it is unguarded by the British, who are here in Princeton. The brigade that's here in Princeton is under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mahood. He has orders on the morning of January 3rd to take his brigade to join the rest of the British Army in Trenton. He has no idea that Washington has just decided to take this back road up to Princeton. And so at dawn of January 3rd, Lord Cornwallis wakes up in downtown Trenton to nobody. You have the Continental Army approaching the farms of descendants of Benjamin Clark, who helps found the Quaker community here in Princeton. And they are traveling through a Great Bear Swamp. So it was bogland, right? One officer wrote, the ground froze as though it were as hard as pavement. Good when you're moving lots of artillery and wagons.
You're not stuck in
the mud. Right, you're not stuck in the mud. Washington has a thing with the weather, which is rather interesting. It somehow always seems to help him out. And as they're marching through, Colonel Mahood's British forces marching south down that main road towards Trenton. At about 8 o'clock in the morning, they cross paths, and the battle begins. It is what we call a meeting engagement, which is a military term meaning an accident. The fight wasn't supposed to happen there, but there it happens. The Battle of Princeton is Washington's first, we say, field victory, right? He has defeated the Hessians at Trenton, but the British can always say, ah, they were Hessians. They're not real British soldiers, right? We can always brush that off, and they do, believe me. This, Princeton, is an open field engagement. It is the kind of fighting that the 18th century military world is designed to be. It's the kind of fighting that the British have never lost to the Americans to thus far during the war. The Battle of Princeton ends up being the first time that the British will lose to American forces in an open field battle.
What does losing mean in this context?
The forces were desperately outnumbered. Let's give them credit. They fought for about 2 hours, outnumbered 5-1. The British Army puts in the work at the Battle of Princeton.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it is a total and complete rout of the British brigade at Princeton. The term we use is shattered, right? No cohesion at all. The commanders are running off in different directions. The soldiers are being picked up in small pockets by Continental Army troops as they come here into town, right? And this battle is one of the more interesting of the 18th century battles because it starts a mile and a half away and then bleeds its way into town. And so the battle begins as an open field engagement, but it ends as street fighting. There's an action at Frog Hollow, which is today the Springdale Golf Course. Over the hollow and up 300 yards to the back gate of the single most recognizable and veritable stone fortress in Princeton, which is, of course,
Nassau Hall.
Nassau Hall. And so this iconic conclusion, British soldiers take cover inside Nassau Hall, smashing out windows, firing down on American troops below. The barrage of Nassau Hall is one of these oft-written about events. In fact, there's so many people who write about it that we have no idea what actually happened. There are many apocryphal stories, right? If you're a Princeton grad or you're a local, you will hear about cannonballs smashing through the back door and decapitating a portrait of His Majesty King George II, that cannonball allegedly fired by a young, no-name artillery captain named Alexander Hamilton.
I'm just like my country, I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot.
We'll never hear anything more about him. One way or another, most of the accounts end the same way. The white dining tablecloth waved out of the second story of the building, calling for a surrender. This is a momentous event for the Continental Army. We've never had a victory like this before. It comes at a significant cost, right? We will lose, among others, at the top of the list is Brigadier General Hugh Mercer, for whom the county you're in is named. He is a Scottish immigrant. He is a survivor of the Jacobite uprising of 1745. He fought with the Bonnie Prince Charlie at the Battle of Culloden. He is an assistant surgeon. So for the Outlander fans in the audience, he's there with Jamie. Comes here to colonial North America. Serves with the Pennsylvania Provincial Forces during the French and Indian War, where he meets a young George Washington. The two of them become besties, and Washington convinces Mercer to move and buy his childhood farm, the Ferry Farm in Fredericksburg. Mm-hmm. So not only are they connected because they're bros, Mercer also owes Washington money. And so the two of them become fast friends. And of course, when the Revolution breaks out, there's no question where Mercer is going to side. And so here he is at the Battle of Princeton, one of the few men in Washington's command staff who had had any military experience prior to the Revolution, struck down in an awfully brutal way. General Mercer is stabbed 7 times in the abdomen, and Mercer is going to go on to become essentially America's first martyr. They make a big deal out of the death of General Mercer. Newspaper articles, the family, they'll start funding basically a pension program for his widow and his orphaned children. They're going to start talking about building a monument to him within weeks of his death. He becomes the poster boy for the brutality of the British Army.
This all sounds very dramatic and also inspiring if someone wants to continue on fighting a revolution.
Yep.
So Mimi, give us a sense of the, I guess, the mood after the Battle of Princeton. I mean, is it a sense of, wow, we've really turned the corner here?
I think Will has said it perfectly. You know, and what I love about details of how hard it was before is that that victory, it was so delicious to the people who saw it. You know, when he talks about, you know, Hugh Mercer becoming kind of the symbol, there's accounts that maybe they thought it was George. It's not like everybody had Instagram and knew what George completely looked like. And so when he's going on that battlefield, he's on his horse, he's wearing the cravat. Well, that's George. Let's get him. So they were so brutal to him, right? And then they left him for dead. And you can imagine when George got to the battlefield, right? Remember, he's got to get to Nassau Hall. That's where the win's going to be. So when he gets Hugh Mercer, who takes his orders and is his good friend, George says, you go this way because we know the British are down there. So he takes 350. George has no idea that the British have way more than that at that point. He just doesn't know. He's trying to hurry to get to Nassau Hall. So he literally sent Hugh to his death, right? Which is kind of sad. But but at any rate, he sent guys that had rifles because he really thought, well, he'll just pick them off, right? And so what's kind of sad about this is that they get down into the lull of the battlefield. They massacre Hugh Mercer. If you're one of the 350, you're like, oh gosh, what's going to happen now? Well, then Haslett, second in command, is like, okay, I'm in charge. Well, the British just shoot him in the face. So if I'm one of the 350, I'm like, okay, I don't care how much you're paying me, I'm gone. And so that's why we had a retreat, and we were running away. It was a lot of activity. George turns everybody around and says, we're going back. So when George comes back to this battlefield. This is like Hollywood couldn't cast it. George comes up. He's tall. He's gorgeous. He's on his big horse. He is cute as a button. We're all running away. And he goes, no, 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 turn it around, guys. Everybody's coming. Let's go. And it's George who then goes down into the swale. And it is, if Hollywood is listening, it is the movie. It's an hour and a half battle, an hour and a half movie. It's a blockbuster. And so my point with it, it was so dramatic of a definitive win that after that, everybody was like, let's go. We've got this.
Yeah, everyone's pretty fired up after this.
So movie. Fired up.
And so, like, we have to wrap it up here. Yeah. We are over time. So, but real quick, Will. So, this is a morale boosting win on top of another morale boosting win. It's unlike the other wins militarily.
Yeah.
So, putting aside the morale, what is the significance of winning this battle?
Cumulatively, right? We have 3 battles in 10 days, which, by the way, is exhausting for an army, either army, any army. It's an exhausting thing to do. In that time, the British have lost about 1,000 men at the Battle of Trenton. Yeah. Another 1,000 men at the Second Battle of Trenton, and another 1,000 men at the Battle of Princeton, right? Now, not all of them are dead. A lot of them have just sort of scattered, and they'll come back. But that's about 3,000 men in the span of a week and a half. That is a lot to lose. Well, now the British are in serious trouble. We enter a period called the Forage War, which lasts from January of 77 till about June of 77, during which time the British are going to take about 3,000 to 5,000 more losses, basically small fights up and down in that quadrant of New Jersey between the Watchungs and the Raritan River. And the result is an army of 12,000 men is reduced by about 20% capacity, in which case your army of occupation can no longer occupy anything. And so the entire British strategy has been scuffed. They have to think of a new plan, right? We have a great line. General Howe writes to Lord Germain, who is sort of the governor general of what's going on in North America, and he says, we can no longer hold the jerseys. I'm going to get it printed on T-shirts.
The British plan is now gone by the wayside, and the Americans have survived.
My favorite quote comes from a
Mimi.
British.
From Mimi.
From a British immigrant. He's come to North America shortly before the war started. His name is Nicholas Creswell. And Creswell writes to his local Tory newspaper down in Virginia. Up until recently, these people, his neighbors, believed that their cause was lost. But after the late action at Trenton and Princeton, they have all gone liberty mad again. I'm going to get that printed on a T-shirt. And that's the big takeaway from the 10 crucial days, right? They have all gone liberty mad again, right? We started at the fall. Things couldn't have been any worse. The fall of 76 to a month later.
Yeah.
And holy cow.
So my sense of it here, after listening to all this, and tell me if I'm wrong or right, is from the time that the rebels declare independence until almost the end of 1776, the feeling is, oh, we stepped in it. We went way too far. Mm-hmm. We've taken maybe a winning cause and turned it into a losing cause. What happens in this pretty short period of time in this part of New Jersey says, oh, maybe that losing cause might actually be a winning cause again.
Yeah.
And thus the war continues.
It provides just enough hope. Yeah. Just enough steam to keep the ball rolling, right? You'll go to a lot of historic sites and a lot of parks, battlefield parks, and they'll say, oh, this is the turning point of the war. I hate that phrase, the turning point of a war. If you plucked one of those men and put them in front of you and asked, oh, do you think Princeton was the turning point? They'd be like, heck no, man. We had 6.5 more years of fighting. What's the turning point? What I say for the battles of Trenton and Princeton, particularly Princeton, and I am biased, but particularly Princeton, is that these are not game-winning battles. They are game-saving battles. Without the victory we achieve at Trenton and Princeton, nothing else can follow, right? It is the spark that will keep the engine running for the next 7 years, right? They will always come back to this moment and be like, yes, it doesn't matter how bad it gets, and it's going to get bad again. It does. 77, they'll call it the year of the hangman for nothing. It's not a good year for Washington and the Continental Army. It'll never be as bad as it was. And they can always come back to this moment to keep that spark alive. The independence is reignited. It's never going to go out again.
All right. Wow. All right. And that was Will Krakauer, historic educator at Princeton Battlefield State Park. You also heard from Mimi Omosinski, founder of the Princeton Tour Company. And shout out to the Yankee Doodle Tap Room in Princeton and everyone who came out to our live event.
Yeah, that was really cool. I mean, you know what? I've learned so much about the Revolutionary War and our visits to the taverns all across our region. And I wasn't like a big fan of the tavern visits, I will admit, but I've been having a ball. I mean, I really have. And it took so much for people to come together. And we were talking about this during the break, that people came together. These were regular folks who got behind an idea, left their farms, left their jobs and their families to come together and fight for an idea.
Yeah. It's almost
amazing.
Hard to fathom. And
we'll
note, we have more of these events coming
up. And they're wonderful.
Keep an eye on whyy.org/events. That's our events page. That's where all of these events will be listed. We'd love to see you at a future event.
Yeah, and we already have one that is going to be coming out for next month.
Nice.
So keep on the lookout. And right now, it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power of the people. That's all we ask in our country. The sick and the hungry.
And that is Power to the People by Curtis Mayfield from 1974.
And thank you to Melody from Reading, all the way out in Reading. All right. Thank you, Melody, for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day.
Yes. And by the way, I want to say a special thank you to the Sheet Sisters who performed yesterday.
Yes.
And they are part of the Colonial Revelers. They were a wonderful addition to our event. By the way, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Special thanks to our live engineer, Adam Staniszewski. Joan Isabella is our audio general manager. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We will talk to you next week.
Yay!
That's all we ask.